Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of England, episode 180, The Lives and the Loves of the Gentry. First of all, just to remind you that I'm a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network, a group of independent-minded folk who like a bit of a cast now and then. You can find out more at agorapodcastnetwork.com. And this month, our featured podcast is 10 American Presidents by Roy Field Brown. You can find out more by going to acast.com/10 American Presidents. Last time, we talked about how the economy affected things for the lords and masters. I was now planning to move on to talk about how all this affected the gentry and the peasantry. But then I said to myself, no, David, no, that would be quite wrong. Because look, you spent all that time reading those dry as dust books on the gentry, so you owe it to your listeners to make them suffer as much as you did. So instead, folks, Julie, we are going to spend the entire episode on the gentry and their attitudes and stuff, and we're not even going to think about economic stuff until next time. I do have a slightly better defence than, look, I've suffered, so I'm going to make you suffer too, valid though every parent knows that to be. The late 14th and 15th centuries were a period when the idea of gentility as opposed to knighthood became part of the language. In fact, by the Statute of Additions in 1413, the term gentleman was formally recognised. But defining a gentleman is just way harder than any of those other terms. So, we know what a king is, don't we? Strong sense of self-importance, crown, needs head cut off, poker up bum periodically, that sort of thing. We know what a baron is in all their various estates, duke, earl, marquis, and so on. Not only are there definitions such as £1,000 of income for an earl, but they all get called to Parliament. A knight was pretty tightly defined as someone with £40 of income from land held in fee. And then a squire, even slightly less well defined, but basically someone with the income, but without having gone through the process of becoming a knight. Then we can define the peasantry between free and unfree. If we call somebody a franklin, they may be reasonably well off, but they are a peasant, pure and simple. Whatever airs and graces they may give themselves, they are marked. But the two terms that emerge into popularity in the 15th century, gentleman and yeoman, both of them are defined first by society rather than first by the state, which actually for the Middle Ages is quite rare. And both of them occupy a messy middle ground across a border. Nonetheless, the term is used more and more in the 15th century and from 1413 in both official and private documents. So, to a degree at least, there was an understanding of what it meant to be gentle. The Wikipedia article on the landed gentry reflects this lack of precision rather delightfully. So it starts off very straightforward. The landed gentry, it says confidently, even brightly, consists of landowners who could live entirely from rental income. And then later, ooh, it includes baronets, then not the peerage, then laments the lack of a proper definition. So all over the place. So hate it or loathe it. The term gentle and gentlemen and gentlewomen and being part of the gentry was always a kind of messy bag of a term. You kind of knew who they were when you saw them and when you smelt them, but would struggle to define why and to write it down. Still, it was super important to some people, at least, to understand the word in some detail because it was a badge that opened doors to the higher echelons of society. Birth clearly had something to do with it. The Pastons were constantly reminded that they originated as peasants until Clement Paston had set them on the road to gentility. And social climbers were roundly mocked, but then I guess they are now. I refer you to Abigail's party. Although that's not really now, is it? But anyway, the Pastons, without doubt, despite the whispers and the secret giggles, were in fact viewed as gentlefolk. So birth wasn't the be-all and end-all. Plus, there were a large number of books designed to teach you how to acquire the patina of gentility. So some people, at least, felt you could buy your way or blag your way into the club. You might hope that gentility would be seen as simply innate, that the universal virtues of love of truth, sympathy, charity, honour, and so on and so forth would mark you out as a gentleman and allow you to be accepted, whatever your estate in life. But, nah. get your terminology of hunting wrong, or have your cap on the wrong way round, and you'd be exposed and humiliated. I don't know how well you know your Chaucer, but the Franklin obviously had a deal of cash and land. He'd been a JP, I think, but his attitudes, dress, outlook still made him part of the peasantry, which at best would be called a yeoman, not a gentleman. During the Peasants' Revolt in 1381, for example, a rich landowning knight called Sir Robert Sowell was killed by the rebels. As they condemned him, the peasants told him, "We know who you are. You are not a gentleman, but the son of a poor mason, just such as ourselves." This was apparently a bad thing, not a good thing, since Robert was then toast. There were things that did unite the whole class, shared values, shared ways of looking at the world, and one of these was chivalry. Through much of the 14th and early 15th century, military service and war in France was a core part of what the gentry did. And indeed, success at war was a way into the club. Even as the war with France ended, the concept of it drove the gentleman's view of what he was supposed to find important, in the sense of the knight, and what the knight was supposed to stand for, whatever the brutal reality, for example, of the chevaucée. There's a nice quote from the time of Henry VIII, when Archbishop Cranmer says, "It was through the benefit of learning and other civil knowledge that, for the most part, all gentlemen ascended to their estate." Now, with the rise of the legal profession, Cranmer was almost certainly right. But it was not the sort of thing you said to a bunch of nobles or gentry. So Cranmer's colleagues had a little sympathy, and they retorted, "For the most part, the nobilities came up by feat of arms and martial acts." Even as the reality became that the vast majority of gentlemen and gentlewomen had nothing to do whatsoever with the more aristocratic pursuits of war or preparation for war, the theory of it and the romanticisation of it became even more important. Your gentleman and gentlewoman looked to copy the interests of the upper nobility, which also lay around chivalry and its ways. So you had to have your coat of arms, and you would have to know all about heraldry. Romances, therefore, extolling the virtues of the knight were everywhere. And however expensive books might be, and they were, these are the titles that appeared on most bookshelves. The shared literature, if you like. So, if you wanted in, you must know your Arthur, and your Havelock, and all of that. When you popped your clogs, you'd make sure there was a nice brass in the local church. The gentry adopted traditional culture, essentially, rather than create their own, a process of acculturalisation to the ways of the upper aristocracy. In the 14th and 15th century, the gentry came to hold a central political role, which was the absolute bedrock of the way that England was governed, whether you happen to think that was basically good or bad governance. Because effectively it was no longer war that defined what a gentleman did, it was much more likely to be law, or administration of their estates, or counselling the magnates or barons as part of their household. A gentleman might possibly take part in national politics. From 1445, that meant he'd need the income of a knight, which is £40, to be an MP. But he didn't need to actually be a knight. But the locality was the real hunting ground of the gentry. This is where they reigned supreme. Some of the bigger brained of you may remember that I flagged the possible start of the institution of JP, Justice of the Peace, when we talked about Richard I. You'd actually have to be quite scary to remember it. Well, by the 15th century, the institution had hit its stride and was a central part of the governance of each county. And the JP was the preserve of the gentry. Through the 15th century, the office grew still further in importance. In 1461, for example, the judicial powers of the sheriff were transferred to the JP. The law encouraged and confirmed that the office was designed for the gentry. In 1414, an Act of Parliament made residence in the shire a requirement for being a JP. And in 1439, they introduced a property qualification of £20. Now, sometimes magnates would get themselves appointed to the bench, but they rarely actually turned up. the office of JP gave your local landowner enormous influence. Part of the career path that began to emerge that the gentry would begin to expect to follow, and very much based on the concept of service. Part of that service might possibly be service at a national level, as an MP, where you got noticed and were given a national or local office. But for most of the lesser gentry, it would be much more likely to be something local. So this might be JP or even sheriff. And it might well be being part of the administration of the magnate's households, as a local administrator or a legal councillor. How this happened tended to vary from shire to shire. But one of the things historians began to look at were the networks that ran society back then, and separate those networks into vertical and horizontal networks. So, an example of a vertical network might be the affinity of a magnate. And some shires were effectively run by such networks. A magnate might be supreme in a particular shire from the land he owned and the offices he held. And in the odd example, this was even the situation for the king, who ran Cheshire, for example, directly through his affinity in the days of Richard II. But equally often, shires were run by horizontal networks, groups of gentry families who together held the power and influence within a shire. And these might not be very large numbers of families, so the administration of Gloucestershire, for example, was never in the hands of more than 18 men at any given time. In 15th century Leicestershire, only 7 families dominated local administration. Places like Kent, Derbyshire, Nottinghamshire were similarly dominated by gentry families and networks. Your average gent sipping his sherry, well, actually not yet sipping his sherry, that'll come later. Your average gent's self-image would probably involve selfless devotion to service. The workhorses of the shires. The shoulders on whom rested the administration and success of the entire nation. As he sat in his hall, a lump might rise in his throat, a tear to his eyes, maybe a small sob would escape as he considered his selfless dedication to his king, lord and country. And of course, even podcasters like to think well of themselves in the face of accusations of nerdery and claim to be carrying out an essential public service for launderers and commuters everywhere. Well, cravenly promoting mattresses and things like that, so how could I judge the gent harshly? But like the shed-bound podcaster, this self-image would be far from accurate. While many public offices didn't formally pay very well and were seen as part of the gentleman's duties and obligations, they could in fact pay very well indeed in other ways. Above the heads of the JPs and constables and sheriffs of the shire rose a cloud of complaints about corruption. And it is undoubtedly true that in some sort of way most office holders were to a greater or lesser degree on the take. So that's the bad bit. But equally, to be fair, the principle of service was indeed strong among the gentry. At the core of the gentleman's worldview was the need to defend the rightful and lawful order of things. This rightful order of things may not appear terribly innovative or earth-shattering to our modern ears, but nonetheless it was deeply held, and not just for cynical self-interest, though without doubt it played absolutely to the interests of the landowning classes. So here we go, the creed of the gentry. Property rights had divine sanction. The divinity that increasingly hedged around the king stretched down to the humblest proprietor. The correct disposition of property, rights, and title was part of natural and divine law. Good governance was the rule of application of effective justice, and that meant guaranteeing that every subject's rights should be his or hers. As far as the gentry were concerned, they, the gentry, were the tools through which these essential truths would be enforced. So hate it or loathe it, despite all the shortcomings of the system and some individuals within it, England was by comparison, by and large, relatively well governed. By an elite who had a respect for law, however much they might bend and twist it at times. the gentry imbibed these values with their mother's milk. Or in many cases, maybe that should be their wet nurse's milk, but you know what I mean. What I mean is that these values underpinned the process of education. I say process because the idea of formal education, of going to school, was not really the main thing in the language of education at the time. The way the medieval gentry family would talk about education would equate more to the how we might use the word upbringing, a wider, less formal term. Even the word schooling didn't mean going to a place called school. It meant to foster or nurture, designed to form knowledge and virtue in the idiom of the gentleman or gentlewoman. Medieval folks thought about life in three stages, and this fostering needed to be designed to meet the needs of each stage. Infancy was dominated by feeding. As far as I'm concerned, pretty much all of life is dominated by feeding, but that's a personal problem it's maybe best not to go into right here. Childhood was dominated by play. But both stages needed to prepare children for the third, adulthood. And that demanded not just learning, but self-discipline. So, the tendency of children to do nothing but play was to be countered with good religious habits like prayer, temperance, and obedience. And countered with good social skills like being well-mannered and articulate. All of which sounds terribly impressive and ever so slightly scary. And there were plenty of books written to extol and exemplify the virtues the well-turned-out gentlefolk ought to possess. For blokes, we might go to Chaucer's squire as the model. His virtues were humility, courtesy, and willingness to serve. He had a range of skills. He could ride and fight and joust. He could sing, compose songs, play the flute and dance. I mean, by golly, how do you manage to work humility into that list? I hate to say it, but the model for Chaucer's women was rather less practical. It's all rather passive, focusing on the gentlewoman's virtues of humility, temperance and modesty. Nothing much about practical skills at all. One other book said that women should be able to read, but the writing was optional, which rather sums it up. Thankfully, it's more than likely that these models didn't reflect reality. But childhood and home life was certainly religious. Children were baptised on the day of their birth. Their godparents were supposed to make sure they could say their Paternoster, Ave Maria and their Credo. When children got up, they had to say prayers and cross themselves. Most gentry households had a chapel. Meals were started by grace in Latin, and visiting shrines was a reasonably common family activity, which I intend to recommend to my family for their summer holiday. Crucially and famously, the gentry believed in sending their children away. Well, don't we all? A Venetian in 1500 remarked on this English habit and was firmly of the view that it was for want of affection. Parents, he said disapprovingly, do it because they like to enjoy all their comforts themselves, and that they are better served by strangers than they would be by their own children. Which seems fair enough, if true. But it almost certainly was not, in fact. The English gentry claimed that sending their children to live in other households helped them to learn how to live better. The same applied to girls as well as boys, though the task of finding somewhere suitable seems to have been much more tricky for girls, and a nunnery might often be the only option. Now, for the girls, all of this was deemed to be sufficient. They could be taught how to read English, and that was considered all they needed as far as intellectual knowledge was concerned. Boys had to know Latin, so unless they were well-heeled enough to afford a private tutor, that meant grammar school. By the 15th century, grammar schools were common, and in fact, the school curriculum was remarkably similar across all of Christendom. And it was certainly a unifying factor for the English gentry, much like chivalry was. The curriculum concentrated not just on Latin, but the stuff they'd develop if they went to university, so debating, religious poetry. Once upon a time, going to university was all about developing clergymen. But the 15th century saw a major shift, with far more going to university to develop their skills for lay careers. But they might not go for very long. A year was reasonably common, especially if they intended to learn just enough Latin to enter the boom profession, the law. To study the law, you went to residential communities of lawyers called the Inns of Court in London, which together housed about 700 to 800 men, of which 200 to 300 were students. In fact, whether you intended to become a lawyer or not, the inns were a popular form of education, because for any landowner, a knowledge of the law was considered pretty essential. Plus, they had the advantage, would you believe, of being more fun than university. Although card playing, dicing, and the bringing in of women at night were banned, so they were too at university. And at least at the Inns of Court, there was dancing, singing, and much more suitable types of exercise. With all this education, it's very probably true to say that the levels of literacy amongst the gentry by the 15th century were very high. And certainly the extent of literacy and their access to learning distinguished the gentry from yeomen and the peasantry. It's also true to say that women had as much skill at reading English as did the men, but probably not as true as far as writing was concerned. That was not universal, of course. Practical women running complex estates like Margaret Paston knew very well how to write. But as a general rule, women had less skills and they were educated less to write. As for how well the skills were applied, historians had tended to rather look down at medieval letter writers, making the assumption that the very direct practical content and the very formulaic format was a sign of lack of skill. But I found it rather interesting to be reminded that letters differed to the modern world, partly because they were delivered differently. So very often, letters were delivered by a servant. Letters quite often referred to information that the servant was going to add, more private or more personal stuff. So it's not surprising that the letter itself was very often the practical stuff. So we are agreed, hopefully, that gentlefolk could read. So what sort of thing did they read? Racy bodice rippers? Religious homilies? Potboilers? Political rabble-rousing diatribes? Or the medieval equivalent of the Racing Post? Well, there are a few categories which reflect what gentry families held to be important. The first thing to note was that despite the arrival of Caxton and the printing press, which I will cover at some other future episode, books in the 15th century were still a very expensive and valuable item. The richest household might have at very most 100. Much, much more likely with something in the region of 40. One of the rather endearing impacts of this was that families shared them with other families. And while they had them in their care, they took notes for the benefit of the whole family through the generations. And so there survived these sort of self-written compendiums or miscellanies, collections of lore for the family drawn from all the books that passed through their hands. One of the things they read about was good manners, social skills. And so courtesy books were popular and increasingly so. And indeed, gentility was itself the subject of poems and stories and romances, all coming together to illustrate the model to which all gentlefolk should aspire. So, when we talk of romances, I don't know about you, but I almost immediately think of Mills and Boone, which is deeply tragic, and of course a long way from the medieval model. Because the romances written in French or English have a constant preoccupation with appropriate behaviour, unlike doctors and nurses. In fact, the 15th century romance appears to be less racy than earlier centuries, and Lord knows they were hardly explicit. Gone, though, are the sexual fantasies. Adultery is rare, courtship leads to marriage, and piety ranks very high. But of course, we also have those classics, like Mort d'Arthur, and history was almost as popular as it is in these podcasting times now. Practical texts were also popular. Hawking and hunting, husbandry and farming, military tracts. Vergesius's De Re Militarii is still popular after all this time, but now joined by Hoclave and Lydgate. Of course, there were religious books. Who could forget religious books? They might be primers in faith, or very popular was the Book of Hours. This was a collection of texts and psalms and prayers with a calendar of the Christian feasts and other stuff, much depending on the particular book. Each one would often be much annotated by its owner. Which seems like the perfect opportunity to move on to talk about religion, and what religion meant in the lives of the 15th century gentry, and it is a delightfully controversial subject, which we will spend much, much more time on, gentle listeners, in the fullness of time. But we'll have a little snifter right here and now. So, when I was a lad, short trousers, dirty knees, hair so high it scraped the ceiling, the story of the Protestant Reformation was very straightforward. The existence of the 21 foreskins of Christ figured prominently. The Catholic Church was bloated and corrupt. It had become irrelevant to the men and women of medieval England in the 15th century, so that by the time Luther took out the hammer and nails, it was ready to fall to pieces. But then, a chap called Eamon Duffy, Catholic historian, came along and changed all of that with one of those seminal books, The Stripping of the Altars, in 1992, which changed all of that so completely that now we have a new orthodoxy. Eamon pointed out that in fact there was very little sign that the church had become irrelevant in people's lives at all, that in fact all the evidence showed that it was a central and vibrant part of the community. The quality of the education of the clergy was much better than had been thought. Even the friars, who had come in for the most stick of all, were nowhere near as bad as previously thought. The reason I mention this here is that if the previous orthodoxy had been correct, the one of the corrupt and venal Catholic Church, you'd expect to see evidence of that in the lives of the gentry in the 15th century, just before the Reformation. Some sign in their approach to piety or to the church or involvement in communal religion. And in fact, there is little sign. In fact, the evidence seems very strong that the gentry were very much involved in religious life, both from the sense of personal piety or involvement in communal religious life. One of the biggest obsessions of the clergy was that idea of purgatory, the place that was neither heaven nor hell through which Christians had to go to be purged of their sins. This was a bad place for the rich and powerful, a bad place who could expect a lengthy period and much punishment therein. Fortunately, there was a way out. The period could be shortened by the prayers of the living. And so we get the Chantry Chapel, chantry from the French chanterie, to sing. Through the 14th and 15th century, England's parish churches became festooned with chantry chapels, endowed by their local gentry, with payments for a chantry priest to sing masses for the souls of the family and speed their way through purgatory. And so, money meant you ended up with a nicer life in the afterlife as well. How cool is that? The parish church was undoubtedly enriched by the gentry. They lavished time and attention on it. And they did that for many reasons, but dynastic reasons, if that's the right word, figured highly. Here was a place to display the grandeur and pride of their family through the generations. And make no mistake, lineage was super important in the minds and attitudes of the gentry. In fact, many churches became more like mausoleums, though none quite as ridiculous as the national mausoleum, Westminster Abbey. The local church was the most splendid place to show off how important you are and have recognised your prominent place in local society. Having your family stuck on the wall or your heraldic symbol on the painted windows could make your paterfamilias' heart swell with pride as he sat through the sermon. Now, me and an old friend of mine, oldest friend of all actually, went to Norfolk recently and had a look at a couple of churches as we once did in the days of our youth. Charlie is something of a traditionalist and grumpily remarked that the pews had been removed and how annoying that was. Happily, that gave me the perfect chance to lecture him about how in fact he was the hideous modernist, since originally churches had always been pewless. By the time I'd finished, of course, Charlie was long gone and was in the pub and I had to rush after him. But the point for here is that pews are now appearing in churches. It's a trend that really takes off with the Reformation and the arrival of the terminal-length sermon. But already the gentry could, to some degree, express their position in the hierarchy by having the best pews. Though really it's under the Anglican Church that we get the worst absurdities of separation. But whether through pews or chantries or gifts, the church was the perfect community location to reflect the gentry's place in society. But do not allow me to become bitter, twisted and cynical, for such eats the soul. There's equally no doubt that there were many excellent reasons for the gentry's generosity, for genuine piety, for love and pride of their community by beautifying their parish church. One of Duffy's points was that religion was a vibrant community activity, where although the gentry could show their superiority, they were also part of the community, rubbing shoulders and taking part in joint projects and celebrations with the hoi polloi. A phrase which incidentally comes from the Greek for the many. Didn't know that. How terribly erudite I was being without knowing it. Personal piety played an increasingly large part in the religious lives of the gentry. As I said earlier, more and more households had a private chapel and chaplain. The Book of Hours began to be mass-produced, so large was the demand, and the practice of personal confession grew in popularity and accentuated the trend towards personal contemplation. There's a famous survival of a story about a visitor to a gentry household who was advised after the evening meal to go up to a cell and pray. The perfect finish to a meal. This is another example of personal piety, which has led some historians to argue that 15th century piety becomes very inward-looking rather than communal, much more in tune with later Puritanism. And there is a strand of the inward ascetic tradition, which includes a contempt for the body and awareness of human mutability. You'll see this as you go round England's churches, when on some occasions you see a tomb with a portly chap or chapess on top and a cadaver or skeleton below. Personal piety, orthodox though it was, also presented a threat to the Catholic faith. With the wider availability of books and devotional texts, the greater emphasis on individualism, the desire to personally analyse faith. All of this brought theological study out of the universities and more into wider life. And theology had always had the power to be subversive, and now the same kind of critical inquiry was more widespread, and the inconsistencies in the Bible, the 21 foreskins of Christ, lay exposed for potential ridicule. So, in summary, religious life was unsurprisingly central in the lives of the gentry and was an opportunity both for personal piety and being part of the community, and demonstrating and indeed wallowing in the social hierarchy at which you sat conveniently close to the top. If there is any evidence of a precursor to the Reformation, maybe it lies in the growth of personal piety, the use and analysis of texts, which would lead to the primacy of the authority of the Bible so beloved of Protestants. There are historians who have detected a rather mechanical approach to Christianity, a sort of going through the motions, suggesting that when something more dynamic came along, the gentry were ready for a change. But it's equally clear that Lollardy, though still in existence, had not grown to be a significant movement. It seems more than likely that day-to-day religious life and festivals were important to the gentry, and as important as they were for the whole community. Religion seems to be central to their daily lives, not something that they were indifferent to. All of these questions are important, since come the Reformation, the gentry will be asked in Parliament to agree and to implement Henry's reforms. Without them, without the gentry, it could very well not have happened. But it has to be said that in the 15th century, it's really quite difficult to see where that support would come from. So there you go. Actually, you will be surprised to know there's a little bit on entertainment that I didn't get to do, and I don't want to rattle on, so I'll find a little spot for that some other time. Which only leaves it to me, ladies and gentlemen, to thank you all for your kind attention and to thank those of you who have donated, such as my faithful and most laudable monthly donators, James, Oak, Bernard, Russell, Henry, and MACRAC, Ross, Alan, Simon, Richard, David. And also those generous souls who have donated this month. Simon, Ernest, Philip, James and Adam. So, fare thee well, gentle folk, fare thee well. And hie thee to the podcast poll